This is an ABC podcast.
Atamarie Talohani and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. There is a lot that is happening across the Pacific region. Who will be Solomon Island's next Prime Minister? And will former Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama end up in jail? And Hawaii is the first American state to approve a resolution calling for a permanent and immediate ceasefire in Gaza. More on those stories shortly. Once our show is done, you can always head to Pacific Beat or Radio Australia as you type that into your search engine, and you can like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram via ABC Pacific. Let's get on with the show. I'm Eggy Dubol and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, after weeks of lobbying, Solomon Island's next Prime Minister will be decided later today by the country's 50 members of Parliament. Two men are vying for the top job, Jeremiah Manele from the incumbent Our Party and former opposition leader Matthew Wale. As Evan Wasuka reports, with no party holding outright majority, every vote will count when MPs meet today.
For the past 5 years, Solomon Islands and Pacific politics has been shaped by one man, caretaker Prime Minister Manase Sogavare. His security deal with China and his flair for drama has placed him at the centre of global media attention. But from today on, Mr. Sogavare will be taking a back seat, and his party's choice to contest the Prime Minister election is career diplomat Jeremiah Manele.
In terms of policies and programs and where the priorities are, the focus on infrastructure will continue to be there. That's important.
While he's a continuity candidate, the MP for Hograno, Kia Havule, was chosen because he represents a change from Manase Sogavare.
Our party lost a good number of candidates. So the political landscape in terms of our party numbers changed drastically. So the coalition partners, our party, People's Face and Candere, thought that it would be important for us to review the leadership.
But Mr. Manele will face stiff competition in today's Prime Minister's election from former opposition leader Matthew Wale. Mr. Wale, the MP for Aokei Langalanga, has been a thorn in the government side. And now he's after the top job.
If I am elected Prime Minister tomorrow, there'll be free education from July this year. I'm happy to see that the New Zealand High Commissioner is here because he's contributing to that bill. You see, he's smiling very positively. No country will develop tries to develop infrastructure and everything else, but does not develop its human resources. You cannot develop Solomon Islands without developing Solomon Islanders.
Mr. Wale, an accountant by profession, has been a parliamentarian for the past three terms, the last as a key critic of the government's diplomatic switch to China. But on the other side, Jeremiah Manele is also signalling a more neutral path in foreign policy, including on a controversial security treaty with China.
That agreement is there. If there is a need to review that, it will be a matter for China and Solomon Islands to discuss.
Journalist Ofani Eremai has been covering Solomon Islands politics for the past two decades. While he's uncertain about who will be Prime Minister, he says both candidates do have the calibre to lead the country.
Both men have the capacity, both men have capabilities to lead. They are formidable politicians, they are formidable leaders. But, you know, at the end of the day, there will be only one of them who will come out from tomorrow's election to be our leader.
And that's Solomon Islands journalist Ofani Edeme ending that report from Evan Wasuka. And as we've heard from our reporter, Evan Wasuka, Manase Songovane, the man who's dominated Solomon Island politics since 2019, is not putting his hand up this time to lead the country, and we are hours away to finding out who the new leader will be for the next 4 years. Will it be Jeremiah Manele or Matthew Wale? Now, the Governor-General will conduct the secret ballot at the Parliament Chambers, and joining us this morning from Honiara with all the details is our Solomon Islands reporter, Chris Narita Almanuleong. With that, I say, good fellow morning, Chrissy.
Good fellow morning, Aggie.
Well, hey, look, earlier this week, you know, the Governor-General's announcement came earlier than many had expected with this announcement of the Prime Minister elections today. I know it's an important day there in your country's democracy calendar. Tell us, what's the feeling on the ground?
Well, Aggie, this morning and, you know, just this whole week leading up to today's elections, there's a sense of people wanting the continuity of a democratic system to be completed with this Prime Minister's election and for the government to get on going with its business. But there's also a sense of anxiety and a little bit of worry about today, as history does tell us that Prime Minister's elections here in Solomon Islands are often not peaceful, and in the past we've seen riots and some form of trouble as well. So in terms of what for precautionary measures and what's been taken steps ahead of today's election, schools in Honiara have been closed. The main central market is also closed today. Although some businesses will open, some will remain closed today. The Chamber of Commerce came out to say, you know, businesses should continue as usual, but to have standby plans in the case of if something goes wrong. But as it is, Aggie, it's peaceful as we speak. And myself and many Solomon Islanders, we're hoping that it does stay that way with the Prime Minister's election happening today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chrissy, can you then just talk us through what will happen next? I know with media itself, is there any access to that or public access to the proceedings happening today?
Well, there are no, since it's not a parliamentary sitting, there's no access for public. Media, however, they have a special access, but of course we also have to apply for a pass to get through to the parliament. Media will not be stationed inside of parliament. We will be outside awaiting when Governor General will retire, and probably that's the first instance where the world and everyone else will know who the Prime Minister of the country is when he comes out to make that announcement. But more on these proceedings, we will hear from the Governor General Secretary, Rockliff Aziza.
There will be a ballot box which is visible to all of the MPs. The ballot box will be unlocked, emptied and locked again before the election commence. So after that one, the names of the MPs will be called in alphabetical order. And as they are called, each one will come forward and then they will collect a ballot paper from the officials. And that ballot paper will be stamped for identification and security purposes. And inside that ballot paper, it contains the names of the candidates. So what is required inside the ballot paper is that each of the members of parliament will be required to write inside the box on the ballot paper only one mark, and that is an X. So that X, you should write it opposite the name of the candidate you wish to vote for. And any other mark that is different from an X on the ballot paper will automatically be treated as being invalid. So that's how the conduct of the election will be.
And that's Governor-General's Secretary, Rockliff Aziza. Chrissy, I know that the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force, you know, they've put out several statements on the security operations ahead of this election. So I'm wondering, what array of measures are being put in place to secure residents and even their properties?
Well, Aggie, it's the highest visibility of a police force I've seen since the Regional Assistance mission to Solomon Islands. I know you were here last year during the Pacific Games, and we thought that would be probably the highest visibility seen, but it isn't. It's safe to say that this week I've seen a lot of police operations happening. The police, a police statement came out saying, you know, the operations are aware of the impact of the riots on businesses and the people, and they want to see a peaceful prime minister's elections today as well. So some of these enhanced security measures to do with the different patrols patrolling around the Honiara itself. So there's been an increase in foot and vehicle patrol from the east to the west of Honiara. There's even use of drones and helicopters in terms of aerial surveillance. And then I've seen quite a lot of a convoy of police trucks, like almost 15 to 20 police trucks just patrolling all across Honiara itself into the suburbs and, around Honiara. There's a deployment of boats as well. So it's not only air, not only land, it's also sea. If there's any threats on water, they're also there. But police and community engagement is probably one that I've heard from a lot. Some of these areas within Honiara are hotspots, and they've seen police going out there through discussions to, you know, instill the confidence and trust back in people and the force as well. Last night, I also saw some police posts being set up in the east and central Honiara. So a lot of that is going on behind the scene. Although this week there were some rumors of a curfew that might possibly be instilled, the Deputy Commissioner for Police have dispelled that. But he's just saying, you know, everybody to continue business as usual. And hope for the best. Hope for a peaceful Prime Minister's election today, Aggie.
Yeah, absolutely. And just quickly, Chrissy, can you just confirm again, the expected announcement is meant to be at what time?
It'll start at 9:30 local time, and we will just, it's probably a waiting game because we'll all be outside. Not sure what will happen inside, but we'll probably know who the new Prime Minister is, whether it's Manele or Wale, around midday today, Aggie.
Awesome. Always great to catch up with you, Chrissy. We really appreciate your time and efforts that have been made there in Honiara.
Thank you, Tomas, Aggie.
No worries. Our reporter live from Honiara in Solomon Islands, it is Chris Narita Almanuleong here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubois. We head to Fiji now, where lawyers representing former Fijian Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama are making a last-ditch legal bid to keep the former military strongman out of jail after he was found guilty of attempting to pervert the cause of justice. Now, the High Court is expected to rule on an appeal on his sentence in Suva later today. Now, we're joined by ABC's reporter from Fiji, Lithe Mawono. There I say, Bula Lithe.
To you, Agnes.
Thanks for joining us this morning. Hey, before we get into the latest development in the story, can you just take us through how we even ended up here at the High Court, given the fact that Frank Bainimarama was already acquitted by the Magistrates Court?
Yes, absolutely, Agnes. It has been quite a complicated and long-winding case, this one. In fact, it had been concluded in, I think that was around October or September last year, when the Magistrates Court had first acquitted Frank Bainimarama, the former Fijian Prime Minister, and Sitiwe Ningiliho, the man who was his police commissioner, of abuse of office and attempting to avert the cause of justice charges. State prosecutors did appeal that acquittal in the High Court in December of last year. And around March of this year, the High Court overturned the acquittal and handed down a conviction. When it did that, it also directed the Magistrates Court to sentence the two men. However, what happened was, in the Magistrates Court, Seni Pumau did not follow the directions of the High Court. Instead, she discharged the conviction, which means you know, they're found guilty. However, a conviction is not recorded. And so all of the implications and the impact of being a convicted criminal don't apply for the two men. And further to that, she didn't hand down any kind of a sentence either, at least in the case of Frank Bainimarama. Sitiveni Ngilihao got a fine. And her explanation, to put it simply, she said it was trivial and that the offense they were being convicted of had no victims. And so the state prosecutors did go back to the High Court to file an appeal on that conviction. So that's where we are now, Agnes.
Goodness, very long winding. And as you've explained, this is a pretty complicated case. So what's the latest saga then in the story?
And so what we found out as of a week ago, just a little over a week ago, is that Frank Bainimarama is pulling out all the stops. His lawyers have filed a number of actions. The most important of it is that they are saying that the acting chief justice who is presiding over the appeal must remove himself, which is basically an implication of bias. And so they're saying that things he said about the magistrate Seni Pomau in the High Court when this case was first brought to mention about 6 weeks ago now, was called into question. They called that into question. So they've applied for him to recuse himself, which basically means that he should remove himself and assign another High Court judge to the case. Secondary to that, they've also applied for a stay order, which is basically to tell the state prosecutors to stand down and not carry out this application for a review or for an appeal on the conviction until something else, another matter that's happening in the appeals court, which is higher than the High Court, is concluded. My understanding is that the appeals court matter can't continue until the High Court matter is concluded. So the stay order is kind of not in play right now. However, this morning, Justice Sally Sitemu, the acting chief justice, is going to hear the recusal matter first. So he's going to decide whether or not he's biased, which is kind of an interesting situation, before he then is expected to rule on whether or not the magistrate Seni Pomau's sentencing was fair.
Wow. Lide, I must ask, I know the High Court is expected to rule on this appeal on a sentence later today. So what can we actually expect will happen later today?
Well, you know what? That's kind of up in the air a little bit as far as some of the other journalists covering the case is concerned. And I did reach out to lawyers familiar with, cases of this nature and some of the lawyers working the case. And the answer seems to be they're not sure how acting Chief Justice Sally Sitemu is going to decide. However, Agnes, given if we're going with Sally Sitemu, Temo's initial commentary when the case was first heard in the High Court just over a month ago now, he is expected to rule today. Both lawyers, both the defense lawyers and the state prosecutors have already made their applications. So the state lawyers have already given the grounds for which they think this sentence must be changed. And the defense lawyers were given time to, in writing, respond to that application. So chances are very high that this morning at around 10 o'clock Fiji time, which is kind of an hour away now, we will find out whether or not Frank Bainimarama goes to jail.
And are we aware as to how long his sentence may be for him, though?
Yes, we have some indication. What we know from what the state prosecutors included when they applied for the High Court to review the sentence is that they're saying that it should be no less than 3 years. And they arrive at that kind of a time based on what we call legal precedent. So cases of this nature that's been heard of in the past, that's been ruled on in the past. So in the past, we have had a former Fijian prime minister go to jail on similar charges. We've had a former Fijian president go to jail on similar charges. So there's definitely legal precedent, not for the same exact charge, but for similar charges. And so based on that, and also on what we call tariffs. And so tariffs are like, they're like a guideline by which judges and magistrates are supposed to decide sentencing. And so the view at the moment in court is that as a judge or a magistrate, you can't just decide, you know, out of thin air, the sentence you give. You must look at aggravating factors. You must look at what's been done before. So based on that, Agnes, we can see Frank Bainimarama being sentenced to 3 years imprisonment, and we can see Siti Veningilihao getting up to 6 years imprisonment. However, I must state the maximum penalty for abuse of office is 10 years, and the maximum penalty for perverting the course of justice, which Frank Bainimarama faces, is 5 years.
Well, we will wait with bated breath. Of course, you say it's about an hour away there in Fiji time. So thank you so much, Lee, there for joining us this morning. I know we will keep in touch with you as to what the latest outcome will be. But again, vinaka.
Malo Pito, Agnes, have a good day.
You too. That, of course, is our ABC's Fiji reporter, Lee Mavono, here on Pacific Beat.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Bobby McCumber, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between.
Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Malo Apito and welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Eggy Dubol, turning our attention to the fact that from the 3rd of June, Pacific Islanders from several countries will be eligible to register for a new visa that will allow them to stay in Australia long term. It's the Pacific Engagement Visa, based on an online ballot, and will allow up to 3,000 eligible Pacific Islanders annually to live and work in Australia more permanently. Most Pacific countries will take part in the program, and Dubravka Volodia asked Professor Stephen Howes, who's the director at the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University, what those wanting to apply should know.
Well, first of all, they have to be from one of the countries that is included in the PEV. That's most of the Pacific countries. So far, Samoa, Kiribati and RMI are yet to be given a quota. So I think if you're from one of those countries, you're still in a holding pattern. And if you have a New Zealand passport, you're not eligible. But otherwise, if you're from one of the independent Pacific countries, then you're eligible to apply for the PEV through this ballot. And to apply, you need a passport, so that's very important. Not everyone has a passport, and it takes time to get a passport. And then you have to apply online, so you need access to the internet. And you do need to make a payment. It's $25, and that's also an online payment. So there are a few conditions, but it's pretty simple. I think the last one is you've got to be between 18 and 45. But dependents and partners of primary applicants can also be included in the application.
Applicants also need to pass certain health and character tests. Well, how that works?
That comes later. So the idea is more people will apply than there are visas. So that's why there's this ballot. And so the lucky ones get their names drawn out of the hat, as it were, and they then have to get over the subsequent hurdles, which, as you said, includes a health test, some sort of English test, police test, and most importantly, they've got to find a job in Australia. So there are some significant hurdles to cross after, and if your name is if you're successful in the ballot, but to actually apply for the ballot, it's just those fairly simple things I mentioned.
More than 1,000 applicants from Papua New Guinea will be accepted, so that will be the biggest draw, won't it?
That has been announced now, and as you mentioned, Papua New Guinea gets far more visas than anyone else. Almost half of the 3,000 go to PNG. It's 1,350. That's a lot. You know, I know from my own work in PNG, a lot of people don't have passports, and it's not It can take a long time to get a passport in PNG. So I certainly encourage anyone in PNG who wants to apply for the ballot, to, if they don't have a passport, to make that your priority.
And do we know how these numbers were allocated?
Well, definitely population was one factor. And so the bigger, so that's, you know, PNG gets 1,350. The other larger countries, Timor-Leste is also included, and Timor-Leste and Fiji both get 300. The smaller countries are like Tuvalu, Nauru, are 100 each, FSM Palau 50. So definitely population was one factor. The government said another factor is how big the diaspora is in Australia. The whole point of this ballot is to build up the Pacific diaspora in Australia. And so countries that have a small, or nationalities that have a smaller diaspora, were given preference. But then there's also, the government's also said it basically depended on their discussions with their, you know, various governments, and I guess how keen those governments are. So I don't think it's a formula that was used. It was rather a range of broad criteria.
Samoa and Kiribati are not taking part at this stage, at least. We know that Samoa, they faced some issues with worker shortages, in particular with the PALM scheme. Do you think that's connected?
Yeah, I think it might be. I think the government is reassessing their migration policy. But what the Australian government said is that none of the three countries that are eligible but which don't yet have quotas, none of them have said they don't want to participate. That's Samoa, Kiribati, and Marshall Islands. And the government, out of those 3,000, the government's actually left 300 so unallocated. And so that's obviously intended for those three countries to take up at some point.
And I understand that both seasonal workers who are already in Australia, as well as people who live in the Pacific, are eligible to apply.
Yeah, that's right. That's a really important point. You don't have to be in the country that you're that you have a passport of to apply. You could be anywhere. And so, yeah, we'd expect a lot of the PALM workers to apply. Obviously, they've all got passports. They have good access to the internet and to cash to pay the application fee. And they'd also know they already have a job. So they'd know that if they are successful in the ballot, you know, they'd have a good chance at the next stage, which is when you've got to go and find a job. So, yeah, we definitely see PALM workers having an advantage, but it won't be only PALM workers by any means, because many people will apply from the Pacific.
Overall, what are the benefits of this visa?
Well, I think the first benefit is that it gives you permanent residency in Australia. It's very different to the PALM visa, which is a temporary visa. And another big difference between the two visas is that with the PEV visa, although you're required to have a job to get the visa, you're not tied to the employer. You can leave that job whenever you want. It's a lot more flexible visa than the PALM visa. And it's also very attractive compared to other visas that Australia offers. You know, when people arrive in Australia, they normally don't have access to the benefits that Australian citizens and those who've been in Australia for a long time are eligible, such as, you know, the higher education loan program and various the family tax benefit, childcare subsidy. So there's a good program, I'd say, of welfare support. And then the third thing I'd say is that the Australian government will set up a service to help people find a job. So, you know, we don't know how quickly people are going to apply, how long it will take them. Word needs to get out. You know, June 3rd is only a month away. So no deadline's been given for the ballot closure. And so therefore, you know, no deadline's been given for when the successful applicants will be announced. So we really still don't know when the first sort of PEV visa holder will arrive in Australia. Personally, I don't think it'll be this year. I think it'll be next year. So there's still time. And obviously there will continue to be a lot of preparatory work underway to make sure it's a success.
Mm. Yeah, that was my last question. I have one more. Any issues you can see at this stage?
Well, it's sort of not finished. I think that's the main issue. The 300 unallocated, that are sort of being earmarked for Samoa, Kiribati, Marshall Islands. I guess that's the big issue that needs to be ironed out. And then, you know, I have flagged the issue with PNG with so many slots for PNG, 1,350. You know, do enough people have passports? You don't want this visa to be only open to the elite, to the well qualified. You want the whole point of having a ballot is that it's available to all.
And that is Professor Stephen House talking to Dubravka Volodia.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Hawaii State House on Monday voted to approve a resolution calling for a permanent and immediate ceasefire in Gaza. It's the first American state to do so. The resolution also calls on the US government to facilitate the entry of humanitarian assistance into Gaza, including food, fuel, water and medical supplies, and to begin negotiations for lasting peace. For more on this, I'm now joined by Brahim Aldey, an ethnic studies professor at the University of Hawaii. With that, I say aloha.
Aloha. Mahalo nui.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning. Brahim, of course, how significant is this resolution?
Well, as you mentioned, it's the first and only state in the nation that its legislature has passed this concurrent resolution, Senate concurrent resolution, concurrent because also the House concurs with it. So it's really significant, and it shows the progressive nature of the state of Hawaii. And especially the Democratic Party. This is a democratic state. To give you an example, the Senate, out of 25 members, 24 of them are Democrats and one Republican. So there's like in the Democratic Party itself a lot of pressure on legislators, and legislators also have to be in concert with the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. So it is significant also in terms of that, here we have the Senate of the concurrent, the legislature of the state of Hawaii urges the congressional delegation of the Hawaii delegation, that is, to pressure even Biden and the U.S. Senate to pressure them to pass a ceasefire, permanent ceasefire, to have a permanent ceasefire. That's one. The other thing is to, as you mentioned, to send aid of all kinds, potable water, medicine, food, etc., because people are starving now. I mean, the children are dying, etc. And the important thing that resolution was based on customary international humanitarian rights that does not that prohibits targeting non-combatants because it is in violation of that Rule 1 of customary international humanitarian law. That's one. The other thing is that they relied on the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, in its decision on January 26, 2024, that there is a plausible genocide going on in Gaza. So these are the two important things that the resolution brings up. So it is a huge thing that gives, especially in Hawaii, because we have a lot of activities against genocide perpetrated by Israeli forces and so on in Gaza. So that gives a lot of support and, propels forward the movement for a ceasefire, permanent ceasefire. on the 3rd, this is a Friday, we're going to have at the University of Hawaii, not an encampment, but teach-in and a lot of activities and the speakers and all of that. And There will also be a march at the university and so on. And the movement here is just growing, you know, not only in terms of students and faculty for justice in Palestine, but also Jewish Voice for Peace and Hawaii for a ceasefire, you know, or Hawaii for Palestine as well. And on other islands, on the island of Maui and the island of Hawaii, which we call the Big Island. And on Kauai, there are people who are working for, you know, support Palestine and, you know, against the genocide, Israeli genocide committed in Gaza as we speak.
Yeah. Brahim, you did talk a little bit about the pressure that this can put on the Biden administration, but I'm wondering, is this more of just a symbolic gesture of solidarity, or you really believe there will be a bit of an influence on his administration?
I can tell you, frankly, like the congressional delegation in Hawaii does not really support a ceasefire. For instance, Congressman Case, Ed Case, he vehemently opposed a ceasefire, although, you know, delegation from, you know, Jewish Voice for Peace and Hawaii for Palestine group went to him, and he just completely said no, because he knows on which side his bread is being buttered, you know. Yeah. So it is symbolic in one sense, but as I mentioned, that gives oomph, you know, like a lot of forward motion to the groups here in Hawaii that support, you know, a permanent ceasefire. We don't want any ceasefire, you know, ceasefire for 4 weeks, 3 weeks, however many weeks, you know, and then what? And then the killing starts again? That's not good. So the U.S. has the power to stop the war, to stop the genocide and the aggression. But it appears that the United States, and at least the Biden administration and the ruling elite in the United States, does not want that, because they have certain kinds of plans for West Asia and North Africa, but mostly West Asia, to maintain dominance of the Zionist state in Palestine, so-called Israel, to keep it dominant over the rest of the region. This is something like, this is a tall order. That's not going to happen, you know, whatever it takes. Yeah.
And look, sorry, we have to wrap up, but I'm just trying to understand. Obviously, Hawaii has a history of colonization. The sense why Hawaii does resonate so well with Palestine and what's happening?
The population, yeah, because all the Hawaii groups, that active Hawaii groups, are in support of Palestine because of the indigenous question here in Hawaii and in Palestine. Palestinians are the indigenous people. And so there is that organic link between the two groups, or between the two spaces, even though one is in the Pacific and the other one is in the Mediterranean. Yeah.
Look, we thank you for your time, Brahim. We really appreciate the work that you guys are doing there in Hawaii on behalf, of course, the Palestine and what is happening there in Gaza. So appreciate your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you very much. Aloha.
Aloha. That, of course, is Ibrahim Al-Day, Ethnic Studies Professor there at the University of Hawaii, here on Pacific Beat.
Join me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. Well, look, the pandemic we know struck many countries of the Pacific subregion very hard, especially those whose economies are highly dependent on tourism and imports. So today we take a look at the International Labour Organization, or ILO's, report that is highlighting the concerns around unemployment within the youth sector. We're currently, the total unemployment in the Pacific region has returned to pre-pandemic levels, estimated at nearly 800,000 in just 2023. The chief author of this report, Christian Figalen, joins us this morning to discuss this matter. Further with that, I say, good morning, Christian.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Firstly, I mean, were you actually surprised by these stats in your report? And also, something like the pandemic, I'm sure recovery after that, especially throughout the Pacific, would have been significantly harder, right?
Yeah, so I think, you know, part of the let's say, trends that we have seen is really, I mean, we have seen that recovery, but we have at the same time also seen that that recovery has been pretty uneven, with Australia and New Zealand being now, I mean, in terms of GDP growth, pretty much back to their pre-crisis path. But then on the other hand, we do have the smaller Pacific Island countries, where really the pandemic has created a big gap in economic activity. And, you know, this gap is really persistent. I mean, there has been recovery, but also recently it has been slowing down. And, I mean, all the more, I think it is quite surprising actually to see that unemployment rates have continued to go down, which is good news. But obviously that's not really the full part of the story, since we also need to look at the quality of jobs that are being created.
Now, Christian, I know you've stated in another report, despite strong job markets, though, you're saying concerns over youth employment remains. Do you mind just elaborating a little bit on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, one of the, let's say, decent work deficits that we see when we look at what is the labor market situation of different groups in society is, you know, when we look at youth, we do see continuously, you know, high or consistently higher unemployment rates among youth relative to adults. I mean, that's not really a particularly specific finding to the Pacific. I mean, that's also what we see in other regions as well. But then the gap between youth unemployment rates and adult unemployment rates is particularly pronounced in the Pacific. And not only that, I mean, we also see, for example, when we look at the share of youth that are neither in education or training nor in employment, we also see very, very high shares among some of the countries in the Pacific. I mean, reaching even close to 50%. And this is really much, 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 much more pronounced than elsewhere.
Yeah. So when we speak again on youth unemployment, what are the difficulties, or in the research that you did in the youth being able to try and find a job?
Yeah, so I think it's really a multifaceted problem. On the one hand, I mean, we do have challenges, or many countries in the region, the smaller countries are having challenges in really creating high quality jobs that would be attractive for local youth to take up. So instead, many youth do choose the option of, or at least consider the option of going elsewhere, migrating to countries like Australia, New Zealand, or in the North Pacific to the US. So I think this is one of the challenges. And then on the other hand, we also have the challenge that those young people that you know, finish school, come out of school, they might not have, I mean, they will have a particular set of skills, but then what we do see is that there is a mismatch between the skills that these young people have and those skills that are really demanded on the labor market. This is one of the barriers that youth are facing when they exit schools to find jobs.
Yeah, I want to get into that a little bit more just later. But you spoke about high quality jobs. I also saw there in the report. Can you speak to the characteristic of like what poor job quality is? Because how important is it to prioritize that, you know, in terms of finding or keeping a job?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is extremely important, and we at the International Labour Organization really put lots of emphasis on this. It's not really about creating any type of job. It really needs to be a good, a decent job. And I mean, what we see consistently in the region is still, you know, quite a significant share of populations that, you know, do have a job, but then they don't really make it out of poverty levels or above poverty levels. And this is, of course, of concern. We do see in some of the countries fairly low wages compared to the living costs, which, you know, also in recent years, we have really seen inflation skyrocketing high in some of the countries. And even right now, consumer price inflation is not really yet back to pre-crisis levels. And of course, then the wage level is something very, very important to consider in terms of job quality. What we also see in the region is fairly high shares of informal employment. So what is that? That is essentially the any type of activity of people to produce goods or provide services that are actually not covered by any sort of formal arrangements, and that includes labor legislation or social security laws. So these are in a sense unprotected jobs, and of course that is a very, very important aspect when you have a job. I mean, you want to have some sort of basic at least employment protection.
Thank you for that, Christian. If you've just tuned in, we are speaking to chief author of the ILO report highlighting its concerns around high unemployment rates, especially amongst youth across the Pacific region. So, Christian, again, is it a matter of there's just not enough jobs or vacancies to actually keep up with the demand?
Yeah, it's I think, you know, that there is quite a lot of vacancies that are out there in a lot of countries, but then it's really a matter of really finding the right people with the right skill set, and you know, some of the countries here in the region are obviously very small countries. So anyway, the type of skills that are, let's say, demanded on the labor market can be very particular. I mean, I don't know, some countries, for example, you know, there would be in need of plumbers or nurses or teachers. And then, of course, it is very difficult, or there are some challenges to match exactly these demands with the supply and, you know, the preferences of, for example, young job seekers coming out of the school that might not really want to go into those particular professions that are in demand.
I want to switch to talking about targeted employment, is what I saw in the report. What does the report highlight in terms of this? Because especially maybe dealing with, you know, gender, women versus men, and then you've also got people who have disabilities. Do you mind sort of explaining a little bit around that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you touched upon the aspect of gender. So, I mean, there is some, let's say, good news in the sense that the share of women in employment and female labor force participation rates in the Pacific tend to be higher than elsewhere. But then still, gender gaps remain in terms of wages. And also in some of the countries, we do see consistently higher unemployment rates among women compared to men. So gender gaps do remain. And then also, for example, persons with disabilities, they also in a lot of instances have actually difficulties being integrated into the labor market. So very often, for example, enterprises lack the required facilities for employed persons with disabilities to make that employment possible and feasible and productive. So, I mean, these are really some of the challenges that do remain, we at the ILO are really, we are working together with a lot of countries in the region to basically develop national employment policies, so comprehensive employment policy frameworks really that cover different areas, skills, social protection, but also entrepreneurship, in order to really make sure that also those economies can create jobs that are attractive enough for people to be taken up and that basically also prevents people from really looking as well abroad for employment opportunities.
Wow. Christian, you know, there was one part in the report that spoke a lot on poverty. And I know this probably is familiar to everyone. Even though you may have a job, you're not necessarily earning enough to live above the poverty line. Can you tell us some more about this?
Yeah, exactly. So that's one of the statistics that we are quite often looking at, because obviously, you know, this is, let's say, some kind of basic requirement or expectation that we can have towards a job that, I mean, it should be at least, it should be more than that, but it should be at least able to basically lift you above poverty levels and you and your family members. And really, I mean, in a lot of cases throughout the Pacific, we see that I mean there are still jobs there that don't manage that. And I mean, even though, of course, if we look back last couple of decades, I mean, we have seen the share of people that are in that situation having a job but not being able to make it out of poverty. I mean, has declined. So I mean, these are good news, but then still. Yeah, a lot of people remain in that situation, so further progress certainly needs to be made.
Thank you for that, Christian. Just finally, as we wrap up, though, moving forward, now that this report is out, what are the, I suppose, legislation that needs to be put in place somehow to help things get moving in order for, I suppose, better results in regards to unemployment?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good and relevant question. So, I mean, obviously things might not really change overnight. So, I mean, some time is needed, but, we are, as ILO, are working with countries, with governments in the region, but also employer and work organizations, to develop policies really to tackle and to address some of those challenges. And based on our experience as well, as you know, world global organization, based on our experience from other countries, really, if there is leadership and really willingness to change things, and I mean leadership really within the countries at the highest level, then it is possible to make a difference and to then make a difference, a concrete difference to the lives of people. So to develop policies, but not only that, to really make sure that these policies are being implemented and then have a concrete impact on the ground. So that's the good news. Something can be done about it. But of course, it requires efforts. It requires funding, commitment, and really that leadership at the highest level.
I love the work, Christian. Thank you so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate the insights into this report, and we hope for good results.
Thank you so much.
No worries.
For having me.
That's okay. That is Christian Figarlan, chief author of the International Labour Organization report. Now that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Taking a look back at our main story, Solomon Islands MPs will decide to the next Prime Minister, with nerves in the country high, as our reporter in Honiara, Kristen Rita Almaru-Leong, explains.
There's also a sense of anxiety and a little bit of worry about today, as history does tell us that Prime Minister's elections here in Solomon Islands are often not peaceful. And in the past, we've seen riots and some form of trouble as well.
Find that report there and that story on our website as you type in Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into search engine. But tomorrow, it's your sports show with Richard Hewitt. But I'll be back next week, Monday, 6 a.m. PNG time. Up next is your news. After that, it's Nita Daily right here on Pacific Beat.